Are you a financial advisor considering the Independent Registered Investment Advisor, or RIA, model and wondering where to start? Start with Schwab Advisor Services. Schwab has helped thousands evaluate the full range of options and can help you determine your best path forward. Navigate the big and small decisions by tapping into Schwab's decades worth of insights on what fuels RIA success. With Schwab Advisor Services, you have a custodian that will support you every step of the way. Start your journey today at advisorservices.schwab.com/paths.
All right. Today's guest is Dr. Justin Hooman. We've been looking forward to chatting with him. I know that we've been doing a lot of urology and men's health content recently, as it's near and dear to my heart, not just personally, but just in general. We're honored to have you join us today. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah. As I was coming into work today, I actually doom scrolling, whatever you want to call it. I was scrolling through social media, and you have some great content, but I happened to see a popular influencer, and I don't know if you have your patients do this or not, but he was measuring his nocturnal tumescence time and scores and actually comparing them to his teenage son, oddly enough, but I guess... it piqued my interest, one, because that is just kind of a strange thing to talk about. Obviously, you want to normalize sexual health and talking about it, but even I was a little taken aback by that. Is there merit to that? Or, what's the deal with measuring nocturnal erections?
So we basically use nocturnal erections as a means to really two things. Number one, assess sexual health, penile health, vascular health. Because what you're doing is you're having an erection under no other influence. It's your sleep. And during that time, it's if you're having erectile dysfunction or if you have good penile health, good vascular health, good blood flow to your penis, it means you're going to have a strong erection at nighttime. That's number one. Number two, we use it as a means to rule out psychogenic erectile dysfunction. Mm-hmm. So there's a handful of younger guys who come in on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, saying, look, I have erectile dysfunction. I think I have erectile dysfunction. And one of the ways we could rule it out is there's devices similar to what this influencer was using to measure nocturnal tumescence, is what we call it. And by doing so, if we could prove that they have good nocturnal erections, we're able to rule out any physiological cause of erectile dysfunction.
So it's more than just paper tape.
Yeah, there's definitely science to it. We're not using it as much as we used to. There's newer technologies, there's better technologies, but there's devices that we have that have kind of gone down by the wayside over the last decade, I'd say, that measures nocturnal tumescence. But yeah, we're not using it as much as we used to, for sure.
Okay, interesting. I suppose if someone's doing this, then they might have a concern for, presumably ED, or maybe they're trying to prevent ED. I know you've spoken about that before. I've heard the figure 40% for psychogenic erections, and I still can't tell if that seems like a surprisingly high amount or low amount. Other than seeing a urologist, is there a way to see if, maybe do a therapeutic trial of something and see if it is partly psychogenic, or what's the other 60%?
So the 40 and the 60%, what you're referring to, it really depends on the age range or the age group that we're talking about. If a guy in his early 20s comes in with erectile dysfunction, I'd say it's 90%, even higher than that, is psychogenic erectile dysfunction. Because at that age, your blood flow, you don't have any chronic diseases, you don't have high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol. You generally have good hormone levels. So the natural causes of erectile dysfunction for an older man, you're not going to be experiencing those at a young age. So as you get older, psychogenic ED, the chances of it become less and less, inevitably. You start to experience the physiological causes of ED with poor health. But to answer your question about how do we assess psychological ED and how do we treat it, clinically, we're able to treat it quite easily just because there's different medications, there's different tests. But one thing I would tell a young guy is, what's the etiology to it all? So one story that really relates with a lot of guys is, a lot of young men, is they've had one bad sexual experience, which is probably their first, whether it's because of a night of drinking too much or being with a partner that they overhype the sexual experience with them, they start to think about too much. They get a raise in their cortisol levels. That raise in cortisol levels decreases the strength of their erection. And then because this is the first time it's happened to them in their life, the next time they're trying to engage in intercourse, they think about that previous time. And again, get a rise in that cortisol and the erection gets worse. So one bad erection leads to two bad erections to 10 to 20. It becomes this vicious cycle that once, I would say once they come into my office, it's relatively easy to treat. Again, with different tests, with different medications, we're able to treat it really snap them out of that vicious cycle. But that's one story that I would say when I express that to young patients, it resonates with them and they're like, you know what? That does make sense. That's kind of what happened. And it really reinforces the idea that this is psychogenic ED versus the physiological cause.
Yeah. So psychogenic, but downstream to psychogenic, they have the adrenaline spike and cortisol spike. So it's like physiologically psychogenic, I guess.
The etiology, right. Like the source of it is psychogenic, right. And it manifests in a physiological, it's all connected, it's all.
Yeah. You can't treat like body and mind and like even metaphysical soul stuff. You have to, that's a tricky thing is they're all completely interconnected, like you said. I agree. So if you give some, let's say someone does not have psychogenic ED, if you gave them an EpiPen injection for, an allergy or an accidental stick, let's say it's an accidental stick, they don't have an allergic response. Would that make it more difficult or less difficult to have an erection?
More difficult. Much more difficult. EpiPen is essentially giving them adrenaline.
Kind of like they get when they have the psychogenic response.
True. So you're compounding it. So, if you think fight or flight, if we're running away, trying to save our lives from, a threat, like you'd say an animal back in the day, the last thing our body wants to do is shunt blood flow to our genital, to our penis. Really, it's going to those organs, the muscles that are meant to help us get away from danger, not so much our sexual organs.
Yeah. Some of my questions that I get from patients are very astute. For example, let's say my ED is kind of psychogenic, would trazodone help that? Because it kind of helps block some of the receptors that adrenaline works on. Or, trazodone does have a dose-dependent mechanism of action. But for the patients that tend to do particularly well on trazodone, for me personally, it's been hard to parse out, well, is that serotonergic? Maybe not a ton at 25 or 50 migs. Is that related to blocking those receptors that adrenaline can bind to? That's been a difficult question that patients ask me. And I'm not sure what your insight with that would be.
Are you talking about trazodone for as a means to address psychogenic or to address erectile dysfunction?
Yeah, some patients kind of, because it is slightly serotonergic as well.
Right, and that could really limit sexual function, erectile function, libido, all of those things. But if it reduces the anxiety, the only thing I'd say about trazodone, it could definitely work. I could see in some scenarios, and obviously different people have different biology, but I wouldn't necessarily say it's first line. There's better options that are higher up there. And to me, in all honesty, when it comes to psychogenic ED and the anxiety associated with it, I'd like to, my angle is to treat it or to address it when they're awake or in the conscious state. Trazodone really numbs them to help them go to bed, help them go to sleep more restful nights. But it's not really doing much when they're awake and engaging in the sexual activity that they're trying to achieve. So I think, again, there's better options. There was earlier options than trazodone, but that's something to consider for sure in some patients who are refractory.
Yeah. What are some of the top options that you like?
So, majority of the time we're able, I'll say this, the majority of the time, just having the conversation with a young guy with psychogenic ED or even any guy, just this conversation of, look, this is probably what you went through. One bad erection is kind of the story I alluded to earlier, at least that and them conversing about it, they just feel like a weight's lifted off their shoulder. Letting them know that this is, you're not the first person who's, you're not the first person, you're not the last person. This is quite common. That really just the conversation helps relieve a lot of their anxiety associated with it. And then really what it is about putting them in a normal, getting that self-confidence back, eliminating that frustration, eliminating that annoyance that they have with the inability to maintain and attain good sexual, good erection. So one thing that I do clinically is put them on like a PDE5, you know, Viagra or Cialis on a regular basis, whether it's a daily basis, a weekly basis, what have you. And really what it does is it reinforces them. They're able to go 0 to 100 with their erections. And every time they want to engage in intercourse, they're going to look down and be like, wow, you know, I'm back. And all of that self-doubt, all that anxiety, all of that frustration really goes by the wayside. And over the course of, it does take months. It's not something that takes days to weeks. It takes months. You're able to, you know, you're able to break them out of that vicious cycle and reinforce, get that positive feedback loop going rather than that negative feedback loop.
I like that. You're using that as a feature, not a bug.
Yeah, right. And listen, you know, anxiety is huge, right? Like day in and day out. I'm sure as part of your doom scrolling that you did today, you saw something about a way in which we could address our anxiety, right? Like I see it all the time on social media. It's just part of it. And the way it's manifesting, unfortunately, it's really spilling into every aspect of life. Even sexual health, which is something when I started my practice, I had no idea that it'd be so prevalent in young men.
Yeah, I've seen statistics that it's orders of magnitude more common, that ED is orders of magnitude more common than it was 10 and 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I don't know if all of that is because of stress and anxiousness or microplastics or testosterone levels or adult videos.
Exactly.
Or not being outside or social connections. It's kind of hard to parse out what percent's what. What's up with that?
I think, you know, from my standpoint, you hit it on the top two. To me, it's abnormal hormone levels as a result of not going outside, sedentary lifestyle, going from one computer screen, you wake up on the phone, you go into the office, you're on your laptop, you come back home, you're watching Netflix. There's not a lot of activity. We're able to really satiate a lot of we're able to spend a lot of our daytime, a lot of our time indoors. So we're not getting that vitamin D. We're not getting a lot of physical activity. We're not eating right. A lot of processed foods, all of those things decrease our testosterone levels. So that's one aspect of it. And number two, I'd say pornography for sure. Pornography is, I don't know if, you know, when I was growing up, magazines had basically transitioned to 56K. So there was the internet that came about, but it was images. And nowadays, it's insane what young men could get, or what any man could really get exposed to unless you really have the self-discipline to control yourself and not fully engage in it. Because at the end of the day, what you see on these videos, you'd be very hard-pressed to find or to match that dopamine hit, all that sensation that you're getting. You'd be hard-pressed to find that in real life.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess the next question is relatively hard to measure scientifically, but I do wonder about how much merit there is to the being there physically in person, because some couples that have good relationships, they are at distance. Maybe they're in the military or they travel or whatnot. So a lot of that intimacy is not in person, where there's pheromones, there's more touch. And, on top of that, I think there might be some merit to the changes in attraction and pheromones that women have if they're on hormonal contraceptive. I think there's like some weak, at least correlation evidence with that. How would you counsel patients that are trying to be more present in person other than, obviously, have a real relationship and be in person as much as possible?
Yeah, it's a tough one in the sense of, in this day and age, there's a lot of these long distance relationships. To your point, try to be as present as possible. But more importantly, when you are present, truly try to be, when you're physically present, try to be mentally, emotionally, spiritually present as well. I think a lot of times, even in those moments, you get caught up in social media, doom scrolling, all these different aspects of distracting you from your present situation. That's one thing I would say. But overcoming the long distance where you have a digital relationship, it's hard to really because to your point, we're physiological. This is all like an animalistic type thing. Can we overcome that in the digital age? I'm sure, but I can't necessarily. There's not one piece of advice I'd say there to optimize that for those couples who are engaging in long distance digital relationships.
Interesting. From the female standpoint, you know, it's relatively well known that pheromones in their social group that they're physically nearby has quite a bit to do with fertility, the regulation of their cycle, even when they have certain hormone spikes. And I know that there's been something postulated called the familial biorhythm, which is basically talking about, well, if there's other people, you know, maybe males, maybe they're around other males, maybe they're around other females, and how this affects their hormone production and hormone output. A common one is, you know, people have a newborn. I have three very young children, and their prolactin increases and their testosterone decreases.
Yeah.
And of course, there's huge confounders. So basically, we don't know if that's directly causatory because, like, the, you know, your spouse's hormones change. Or is it your terrible sleep and your habits are worse and your diet's worse? Do you think that there's a strong component to, quote unquote, males having natural hormone fluctuations that are just going to happen no matter what?
Definitely, definitely. There's the independent, there's the hormonal changes that happen independent of, let's say, our partner, our female partner, for example. Throughout the course of the year, testosterone levels will fluctuate seasonally, right? Summertime versus wintertime. Part of that is because it's seasonal. Part of that is because we're spending more time outdoors, more physical activity, higher testosterone levels during the summertime, more vitamin D along those lines. That's the solo aspect of it. Now, when you can, you know, when you're with a partner in that sense, it's interesting because, you know, I think I know which study you're alluding to about after having children, they've done studies where the man, his testosterone levels decline. And to me, I do believe that. Can it be lack of sleep? Can it be all of that? That's contributing to it. But to me, more importantly, I think there's an evolutionary idea behind it where our testosterone levels decline as a means in which to no longer seek other reproductive partners or other partners to further procreate, rather put our energy investment into this child. And by doing so, allow for this child to get reared and grow up as healthy as possible. And that's, I think that's something evolutionary over the course of thousands of years, our ancestors, that behavior has been instilled in us, where the opposite of that behavior has slowly probably died off.
Yeah. That I do think that that's a fact. Just don't like it a lot. That's why after I had my third kid, I like to keep my DHT very low and my testosterone high. Because, you know, 6 weeks of pelvic rest is certainly a thing as well. It's one of those things, if you know, you know, I guess. Speaking of fertility and testosterone, do vasectomies decrease testosterone, and or do varicocelectomies, where you fix the varicocele, like the varicose veins, do those significantly and permanently increase testosterone?
So the vasectomy question, so vasectomies are incredibly, incredibly safe. I mean, this is one of the things that I always try to tell guys. There's zero impact on testosterone levels, sexual health, erectile strength. There's theories about prostate cancer. It has zero impact on prostate cancer. Vasectomies are incredibly straightforward, take 7 to 8 minutes to do, and it has zero impact on anything but your sperm production, not even your semen production, just your sperm production. So you still will ejaculate the same amount of fluid because sperm is only 1% of the volume. So you won't notice anything. So to answer your first question, vasectomies have zero impact on testosterone levels. Now, varicocelectomy. So varicoceles, just to give a highlight about what this is a varicocele is a varicose vein of the legs, right? Of the testicles. And what that means is the testicles like to live in a very narrow temperature range. When that temperature range is elevated as a result of blood pooling around the testicle because of the varicocele, it could cause dysfunction, primarily sperm production dysfunction, but could also impact testosterone levels. We have some studies that support this idea that if you correct the varicocelectomy, you'll have about a 90-point improvement in your testosterone levels. Some men, obviously, will be a higher improvement, some men lower. I wouldn't necessarily say that it's permanent, because as we age, our testosterone levels will decline. But as a temporizing measure for hopefully a couple of years to a decade or two, it should improve your testosterone level. Okay. But if I could say one thing, I wouldn't necessarily do a varicocelectomy as a primary means in which to improve testosterone levels. There's other non-invasive ways in which we can do it.
Yeah. A good way that I've heard it explained is you can do it for pain/symptoms or do it for fertility, but not necessarily worth it just for testosterone levels.
Well said. Exactly. Those are the two main reasons I would actually do it. Yeah.
So let's say that there is some degree of social interaction when it comes to the seasonality of testosterone levels, or just how testosterone levels raise in and out of a group. Just like we know that that's the case for female cycles. What happens when one person in a, let's say, a social group, close friend group, but you know, going back to tribalism, starts testosterone replacement therapy? I guess you could say everybody starts TRT, but let's say they didn't. What would happen? Do you think that would have any other impact on the rest of the group's hormone levels?
I guess it depends on where the baseline of the group is in terms of where their hormone levels are. But in my mind, if you want to think about this in a tribal cultural way, that one individual with TRT will become much more of the alpha, and the other ones become more betas. Now, how does that impact testosterone levels? It can definitely impact testosterone levels. I don't have any true data to support this, but it could definitely impact testosterone levels in the sense that the alphas' T levels will be obviously much higher, and the betas will, as a result of that, become slightly lower. I would say that's my sense. Again, I don't have a lot of data to support this, but that's my sense. I don't know if you have any ideas on that yourself.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of data in dogs, both wolves and actually domestic dogs as well, that are like high-level competing dogs. And not necessarily has to do with dogs on TRT, although that's a topic that I very much enjoy, but probably out of the scope of the conversation for today. But oddly enough, if the owners had higher testosterone levels, the dog's cortisol levels tended to be higher when they were competing. And if the dogs did better, then they tended to receive more praise if the owners had higher testosterone levels. They also tended to do better. So it's kind of hard to say. But when you look at wolves, and I know I've made posts about both of these things in the past, the dogs with the highest testosterone levels were the loners, whereas the alpha wolves had, like the alpha male wolf, had the highest cortisol level. Of course, I made the joke, maybe that's because he had to deal with all the females in the wolf pack. But I don't know if that extrapolates to humans or not.
Interesting. Yeah, I guess it does make sense. The wolf, the solo wolf one, it's hard for me. I'd have to think about that one. But when it comes to cortisol and the stress hormone, yeah, that does make sense. Obviously, there's an interplay with stress and testosterone levels where they're inversely correlated. So that does make sense with the dogs.
I like the explanation that if you either naturally optimize your testosterone or replace your testosterone to a optimal, relatively high level, if you can do it safely, then it tends to make you more extreme, or not more extreme, more animated version of yourself. So if you tend to be a particularly social individual, then you'll probably be more social. Or if you tend to be a loner, but you're doing social things because you're just kind of going along with the program, then you will kind of return to your true north, if that makes sense. So I think there's probably some merit to that, of why some people will start TRT or way more than TRT. I mean, think of bodybuilders. Some bodybuilders are in these big social communities and they're hyper social. And then some go on, five times the amount of androgen that's in TRT on a steroid cycle. And they start getting in trouble with the law, and they become aggressive, and they get in fights, and they're loners with no friends. So I think that the vector is kind of decided by, you know, you're already headed in that direction. Testosterone just accelerates how quickly you go in that direction. Almost like with androgenic alopecia.
It shows itself. It kind of.
It accelerates what's kind of going to happen anyway.
Right. With increased, same thing with prostate cancer and testosterone, same idea. It's not that so much that testosterone causes prostate cancer, but it just shows itself. But I agree with that explanation. You know, testosterone and your mood and your personality, it reinforces who you are as that individual, rather than getting caught up in the, some of the superfluous aspects. But yes, I've heard that theory and I do agree with it.
One thing that I've heard you talk about recently is the relatively newly available oral lymphatically absorbed testosterone undecanoate options. There's a couple different commercial products, much safer than previous oral testosterone. This is part of a question just to help me clinically. And I know there's a lot of ways that these benefit patients that other forms of testosterone replacement don't. But I'm so confused that insurance companies that don't approve this, that ask for a prior auth, often one of the recommended step therapy options is methyl testosterone, which I don't think I have ever used. I don't know if you're also seeing this, but I just found that so strange.
Yeah, for whatever reason, these insurance companies, they will do anything and everything to avoid insuring oral testosterones. There have been two companies that essentially have gone down by the wayside, or two oral testosterone products have gone by the wayside as a result of this very difficult insurance reimbursement. Now there's a newer company out there. There's a newer product called Kysotrex, which they completely avoid the insurance game. It's all cash, and therefore it's much more readily available to consumers. And it really, oral testosterone, really, it's fantastic for the right man, for the right type of guy. There's so many great testosterone products out there that we're just trying to fill these different niches and subcategories of men. And this has really opened a lot of doors for the younger man, for the man who's not trying to experience significant side effects, who's trying to microdose in many ways. It does a very good job in that sense.
If someone is trying to microdose, do you see potential therapeutic benefit for regimens that more naturally, quote unquote, mimic, higher levels in the morning? Obviously, people aren't going to be doing troches and RDTs and tablets before they wake up. But do you see this picking up steam?
Yeah, I guess microdosing for testosterone is a little. It's more difficult to it's difficult to trend it or to follow the physiological trends that. But we have when we're young, but the microdosing, what I'm referring to is just that rather than doing a weekly dose or large weekly dose, or even some guys are doing even a larger twice a month dose, that can obviously you get the high highs, but you also get the low. Anything that you really throw yourself out of that therapeutic window, it really creates, that's when the side effects start to come about. So with testosterone replacement, if you're giving yourself these large boluses on a weekly basis or every twice a week basis, that's when you get the increase in red blood cell count. That's when you get these bumps. A lot of times guys are like, I'm losing hair. I feel like I'm losing a lot of hair. So you're getting these massive rises. You're getting the conversion to DHT. Same thing with gynecomastia. You're getting the conversion to estradiol. So microdosing, I have patients. A lot of my patients do twice a week. They'll inject Monday and a Friday, and just to try to maintain therapeutic doses throughout the week. But again, this oral therapy option, it's twice a day. You're taking morning and evening. You're really staying narrow, really nicely in that therapeutic window. Again, minimizing a lot of the side effects associated with TRT. Which, look, to me, TRT is wonderful, and I know you share the sentiment, but TRT is wonderful for the right guy. In many ways, I can't wait to the day I'm on TRT just because I see what it does to a lot of young guys, a lot of men.
Yeah, for sure. And I've talked about my HCG and or TRT journey for quite some time, my varicoceles and whatnot. So Cameron can link a bunch of those episodes in the description here. But One of the things that a lot of patients have asked about is, you know, something like a basal bolus testosterone. So just like diabetics have insulin. And this isn't something that I frequently do, but given that there's a couple different oral testosterone options now that you can get for about $1 per capsule, something like 100 milligrams with breakfast and lunch instead of breakfast and dinner. And then on top of that, you know, say 35 to 40 milligrams of a longer acting testosterone ester twice a week. So let's say test sip, 40 mgs twice a week, the Monday, Friday, exactly how you said, subcutaneous. And then on top of that, a slightly higher testosterone level, a bolus, if you will, and then it's a bit lower at night to decrease their area under the curve. Unfortunately, there's no good outcomes data, and we don't actually know, other than, I guess, the couple patients that we may have had on a similar regimen, if this is better. I'm not totally against it, but it does kind of seem hyper complicated for me. But I wouldn't be surprised if a company comes up with a product that has both of these options in the future.
Yeah, that's quite interesting that you say. My idea with that, I think, are you talking about younger men in general or any type of man for that one, for that regimen?
Yeah, pretty much any male. If it's younger males that or older males that want future fertility, then I do tend to avoid injectable and just things that would decrease intratesticular testosterone or fertility in general. But this would be more for the male that would really, that's really, really naturally minded, that is hesitant, that would probably do very well on twice a week subcutaneous injections, but is very hesitant to do something that does not mimic the natural diurnal rhythm.
Right. What about the idea? I mean, I could see guys who want to mimic that natural rhythm with doing N-clomiphene and HCG, for example, combining those two, because you could still mimic with N-clomiphene, your body will still mimic the natural curves. But again, that's only for younger guys, who, yep, you know, 50s and 60s, N-clomiphene really isn't for them.
Yeah. Yeah, agreed. It's an interesting thing. The other interesting option for the future is Avid, which is kind of the American version of Nibido. I'm not sure what your thoughts are on that. I tried to look through your previous videos and I couldn't find many, but it's my understanding that this is testosterone undecanoate, a very long acting ester, but it's in a very thick carrier oil, castor oil. So it takes a very long time. It's kind of an alternative to pellets, which of course I think is particularly interesting because you're not going to like extrude this or whatnot. But I wish that there was other testosterone undecanoate options. Do you use this a lot clinically, or do you see this becoming more and more popular?
Yeah. So Avita, historically, it's been a little bit difficult to get here in the States, at least get insurance coverage. But prior to it, you're right, it mimics the pellets, right? Similar, the mechanism is similar to the pellets, where you're putting these pellets, whether Avid or the pellets, in the muscle, in the subcutaneous fat. And over the course of 10 to 12 weeks, they slowly dissolve, but it really gives you a nice steady state of testosterone. So you're not getting those rises and falls. In theory, because of that, you're not really getting the side effects associated with the rises and falls of testosterone. But I wouldn't necessarily recommend that for young men. Young men don't really respond well to the pellets. It's more for men who are like difficulty in injecting themselves. Logistically, they can't get to a doctor who can inject them. It's more of an ease of, it's meant for men who have a difficulty in administering the testosterone, not so much men who could benefit from it. Because from my sense, and I could tell you this, whether it's, you know, urological cancers, just biologically, anytime you're increasing the frequency of exposure of something, where you're smaller microdosing, essentially what I mean is, it for biology, it's generally better. Giving anybody anything that stays around for a long time and gives them a longer continuous dose, it biologically doesn't have the same benefits. Again, this is not for everybody and it's not for every pathology, but generally speaking, that's my view, at least clinically and anecdotally. That's what I could tell you from my clinical experience.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Less
Less is more.
Less peak and less trough. Steady state, even though it's not physiologic, is great for replacement because it gives you a better ability to adjust. And you know you're not catching a level when it's abnormally high or low. So yeah, I avoid peaks and troughs, and I generally don't care that much about peak and trough testing because trying to dose in a way that you don't have a peak or a trough. I do hope in the future that there's a testosterone undecanoate commercial product, ideally an auto injector that was in something like cottonseed oil or sesame oil, with kind of a medium viscosity instead of a thick viscosity, that could very easily be dosed weekly or maybe every 2 weeks. So you can still have a lot of dosing adjustment. And I would be shocked if that does not come with one of the lowest risks of things like thick blood, which we call erythrocytosis, at least. Probably not going to beat nasal testosterone, but would probably be at least relatively close. One thing that I heard a popular, I guess, testosterone doctor say is, you know, when you start testosterone, you can expect things to improve within about a month, which kind of makes sense because if it's subcutaneous, then, you know, it might take a while to get to that high steady state level. But he said that TRT makes you, quote, literally resurrect from the dead. So I assume this was hyperbole. What do you tell patients that are actually deficient in testosterone and what to expect versus a patient that might have a bunch of symptoms of low testosterone, but might have a total T, let's say their total T is very consistently 310. What do you tell patients to expect in those situations?
I'm a big fan of TRT, but when selling it, if you will, to a patient, when I explain it to a patient, I try to set the bar quite low. I never try to oversell it. Like, this is going to change your life. This is going to make you like you were 18 again. I never try to do that. The level of improvement. So if a guy comes in and his testosterone, I've had guys who've come in, their testosterones are literally under 100, and they'll see once they get on a good regimen after 4 to 6 weeks, they feel, you know, wonderful. And does that feeling of wonderful stay around forever? No, but, you know, it does. They do stay pretty good going, you know, for many, many years going ahead. If you have very, very low testosterone levels, you will definitely feel the benefits of TRT. But again, I never really try to oversell it. For those men who they have their total T's in the low normal range, the free testosterone is more important to me. I like to see what their bioavailable testosterone is to see where they're at in that regards. And my overall theory here is not so much, you don't want to treat the number, you want to treat the symptoms. One of the big, big misconceptions to me about testosterone is we say the range is 300 to 1,000. Now, I know where my testosterone, when I'm in the 500s, I feel great. But for you, maybe you need to be at the 750s to feel fantastic, right? So everyone really has a different baseline. And to say, if you're 301, you have normal testosterone, but if you're 299, you have low testosterone, it's pretty unfair. So you really want to treat the symptoms, not so much the number.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect outlook. When you're treating symptoms, and this comes from our conversation with the wise and kind Dr. Jake Fantas, but he mentioned that he has patients come to him after doing, you know, TRT plus, which is kind of like a steroid cycle. And he replaces them to a good level, maybe up to a total testosterone. Let's say their total testosterone is 900. Their DHT is also high, and they still just don't feel great. And we definitely got some good comments for the algorithm about how this is completely different from coming off of any other substance. Like, you know, when you come off Adderall, you also don't feel great. Or, you know, when you come off cocaine or you're like any of these other substances, you don't feel great. And I understand that there's some differences, but I mean, that should be, how do you explain why someone might have a completely normal testosterone, but when they have a total testosterone of 2000, they feel fantastic. And then when they have a total testosterone of 900, a couple months after that, they just really don't feel good, because that is a fact. And I'm sure that we've both seen this.
Yeah, to me, it's, I used to think that it's a non-hormonal thing. At that point, it's like a mental thing. But I've, over the course of the last few years, my sense for that is their receptors have tasted what it feels like to have a testosterone level of 2000. And once you get a taste of that, once you get a feel of that high, it's incredibly difficult to match that. It's, to your point, similar to drugs, right? Once you feel something that good, it's hard to mimic that feeling unless you get to that feeling again, unless you get to those kinds of levels. That's why, you know, TRT really, like, if there's one thing I tell guys all the time, and I'm sure, look, this, you know, your education for this when it comes to testosterone is so valuable, because a lot of healthcare providers, there's a lot of these like shopping center TRT clinics, which aren't doing it correctly. And they're giving guys too much of a dose or not informing them about the fertility risks, what have you. And it creates this creates a bad name for testosterone replacement, because it has to be done. It has to be dosed appropriately. It can't be done on the black market. It can't be passed around in the gym, because you're going to dose it wrong in some cases. And you feel like crap.
Yeah, I agree 100%. So hopefully people are hearing this before they go on too much of a TRT plus protocol, if you will. Another thing that really piqued my interest discussing with Dr. Fantas is Botox for ED. And I see that you're kind of a knowledgeable expert source of information regarding this too. By the way, as a provider who injects a lot of botulinum toxin products and who's very comfortable with, treating faces and migraines and AC joints and things like this, I'm also kind of curious about treating patients, but certainly the location of the injection is a bit of a hesitancy for me, just because I'm not accustomed to do that. I'm not a urologist. What advice do you have for patients that are thinking about Botox as an ED treatment? And then also just for me or providers that are comfortable with Botox, but don't know if this is something that is kind of best left to urologists, or it is a potential therapeutic option to offer.
So we know that there's good data supporting the idea of Botox for erectile dysfunction, for impotence. The data supports the idea of, we do penile ultrasounds and we measure, in simple terms, we measure blood flow in and blood flow out. And the peak systolic velocity, which is a blood pressure term, but it's the high point in terms of the arterial velocity, has a statistically significant improvement after a Botox injection. And the mechanism really is, Botox, we know, relaxes smooth muscles. The blood vessels in the penis primarily comprise of smooth muscles. So when they get injected, they're going to vasodilate more, allowing more blood flow into the penis, which means stronger erections. Now, that's the data that we have. Now, anecdotally, I could tell you guys love it, right? I have patients who come in every 3 to 4 months. They come in for a quick injection, and it's what for them. Now, when you think of, let me take a step back here. When you think of erectile dysfunction, there's mild, moderate, and severe. Each of these, you know, different treatments fill different buckets. But I wouldn't necessarily say that if a guy is having no response to any of the oral medications, if he does Botox, he's going to start having great erections going forward. He doesn't need any medications. That's not what it's going to do. It's going to move the needle a little bit. So let's say they have to take daily Cialis for their erections, a low dose, and they're having 7 or 8 out of 10 erections. By doing the Botox, they could get to 10 out of 10 erections. So it moves the needle. But it's not something that's making a massive difference in the strength of their erections.
For patients with Peyronie's, do you inject one side more than the other asymmetrically? Or do you have them, like if there's a patient also doing a stretcher device or a pump or something like that, whether it's for Peyronie's or they're on ADT, do you stack Botox injections on top of that as well?
I don't. You know, when it comes to Peyronie's patients, their main concern is fixing the curvature. They really don't want, they're not really interested in, well, I'll take that back. Their primary concern is correcting the angle. Once we correct the angle, once we correct the curvature, then we could address the erectile function. But at least from my clinical experience, there's never been a patient who's done Botox at the same time of, like, for example, the Xiaflex injections for Peyronie's disease. We don't do that at the same time.
Interesting. How about PRP? Do you do that at the same time as well? Because I know some people will even like reconstitute Botox with PRP, which is platelet-rich plasma, for people that aren't familiar.
Exactly. Platelet-rich plasma, which is a great, it's great. We have a lot of good data on it. If you asked me 3 years ago, again, anecdotally, I would have told you that patients are responding well to it. Now we have clinical data, probably came out 18 months ago. We have clinical data supporting the use of PRP for erectile function. That does work well. There's PRP, pure PRP, which is generally two injections separated by about a month. There's PRP with exosomes now. That's becoming a little bit more of a common request amongst patients. But PRP with Botox, I try to separate those two. I try not to do them at the same time, only because I don't know I don't know how those two interact. No one really does, so I try to keep it as plain and simple, at least at this stage.
Do you have a go-to PRP exosome protocol yet?
So for exosomes, you could really, the range is anywhere from 5 million to 15 million. Some patients just want the exosome. Some patients want exosome plus PRP. So it's really PRP plus 5 million or PRP plus 15 million. That's really the idea.
Yeah, I believe that's for mesenchymal-derived exosomes like Chimera. And then for adipocyte-derived exosomes like Benev, that'd kind of be a not homologous product, if that makes sense.
Exactly.
Maybe both are reasonable, but yeah, I like to differentiate between like the mesenchymal ones, which people can think of as like the amnion or like placental derived, and then adipocyte derived is just coming from fat stem cells. But yeah, I'm personally more excited for the clinical application for exosomes than the clinical application for stem cells.
Interesting. Interesting. I would say my view of exosomes, so I would rank it like this in terms of the newer therapies for ED. Shockwave to me is probably the best that we have out, then PRP. And then between exosomes and stem cells, it's, stem cells, I would probably say a little bit lower, only because if you're going to do stem cells, it has to be done correctly. And at an academic institution where it probably takes a couple hours in order to get your own stem cells, harvest your own stem cells, process it correctly. And many, many clinics or institutions really don't have access to that kind of they don't have that facility to do it appropriately. So yeah, I would say probably exosomes are a little bit better than stem cells as well.
When it comes to PDE5s, which I think you mentioned is, you know, they're still kind of first line, and I do like the daily microdose. Do you have a preference on tablets versus dissolving troches versus rapid dissolve tablets?
All depends on how you want it to function in your day. So you and I probably see very eye to eye on this in terms of the daily dosing. We know that PDE5 inhibitors, specifically Cialis, to me, Cialis is probably better as a basal dose. We know that it's good for not just erectile function; it's good for blood flow to your pelvic area. There's some scant data to support it. Good for just vascular health, overall vascular health. One of the big concerns among patients is, do I develop a tolerance to it? Now, biochemically, it just doesn't work that way. You're not going to develop a tolerance to it. If their erections are getting worse on Cialis, that's just the progression of disease, or that's just worsening ED. It has nothing to do with how desensitized you've gotten to the Cialis. We also know that in animal studies, there's evidence to support that rat penises, they've done biopsies of rat penises after 3 months of putting tadalafil in their water. The penises are essentially healthier. The smooth muscle is healthier. The smooth muscle is more, has more vitality to it, just because the penis is getting more blood flow throughout the course of the day. So I'm a big believer in that. Now, to answer your question about the troches are fantastic if, as long as it fits when you need it. So, you go out on a night of drinking, or dinner and drinks with your partner, and you want you want a hit of the PDE5 inhibitor. Oral dosing, Viagra at best, will take an hour or two. If you're on a full stomach, it probably won't even work that well. We have Levitra, which works pretty well. That kicks in within 15 minutes. But the troches are unique in the sense that they're sublingual; they get absorbed quite rapidly, and they could typically kick in. And similarly, in 15 to 30 minutes. So there's a role for the troches, definitely. But fast rise, fast fall for the troches, whereas the daily tadalafil is more of a basal, steady, long-term dose.
Yeah, that's a great summary. Yeah, a lot of people like the troches and the rapid dissolving tablets / sublingual tablets. They'll hold their daily dose maybe a day or two before if they're really trying to optimize things. And even for people that don't necessarily have pathologic ED, I think it's reasonable to want sexual health optimization, given that people do, you know, cognitive performance optimization. We're taking nootropics. You do athletic performance optimization. You're taking your pre-workout and your creatine before your workout. So yeah, I am certainly not against improving another area of my life safely, if that makes
sense. If there's one thing I could say, though, about the daily dosing, this is something that I've recently started to recommend, is you have to cycle, even the daily dose of Cialis, cycle it, right? If you're a guy in your 50s or 60s and you're doing it daily, that's fine. Nothing wrong with that. But take a week off here and there, right? Maybe do it for 3 weeks and take a week off. Maybe do it for 7 weeks and take a week off. But you have to cycle. Otherwise, and not because of getting desensitized to it, but just for, I'm just a big believer in anything, any supplement, any medication, unless you're taking medications that are life-saving meds, you have to cycle them.
Yeah. I guess on the subject of safety, for pilots or for people that, let's say they're like artists or painters, and they really want to preserve their color perception, I'd previously heard that the like relative slight color blindness that PDE5 inhibitors like tadalafil can give are dose dependent, but I have heard reports of even 2.5 mgs per day or every other day can affect that to some degree. What advice do you have for people in that situation?
It's quite rare. So yeah, we do know there's a color blindness associated with some of the PDE5 inhibitors, just because of cross reactivity with another receptor. But it is quite rare. But in those scenarios, similar to what you said, either go down to the 2.5, see how you do on that. Do a 2.5 once a week and then build up from there. Do, you know, if 2.5 once a week is okay, maybe go 2.5 twice a week and you slowly build up. But it's this interplay of desensitization of or normalizing that receptor. So you, to your point about dose dependency, you're not hitting it too hard. What is it now? Are there scenarios where some guys just can't handle it? Absolutely. I probably have three patients that I remember who have unilateral deafness as a result of the PDE5s. And in those scenarios, you know, I don't play around with that one. To them, this is not for you. You can't go on a PDE5. You have to find another option for treating erectile dysfunction. The hearing is way more important than the erections.
Yeah, that's kind of the same approach I have. If someone happens to have retinal detachments or like a strong predisposition for retinal detachments, I mean, it just goes to show that even some of the safest medications can have adverse effects. So that being said, neither one of us is saying these things to scare people away from one of our favorite meds.
Right, exactly. A very safe med.
We've spoken for almost an hour, and you're obviously also a fertility or reproductive health specialist, and you have you're well trained in those areas. And I suppose as a urologist, I'm always interested in, you know, what can people try and how long can they try before seeing you for, I don't know if you do like surgical sperm extractions or things like that, but certainly I assume that those things are good for business and whatnot. And it's great that we have urologists that do surgical sperm extractions. But one thing I've noticed with OBGYN REIs is they almost always just kind of skip to IVF regardless. So I guess at risk of putting yourself at less business, what can people try before skipping to a surgical sperm extraction? When is the time when they should just go ahead and skip to that surgical sperm extraction? And then how long do you generally recommend they try? You know, it might depend on their health and their age and whatnot, but what advice can you give with that?
Great question. That's a really good question. It's becoming more of a the IVF cycles. To, you know, I would say a couple of years ago, I would have patients come in. They tried either zero IVF cycles or maybe they've tried one, and they're like, "All right, well, maybe it's the male factor now." Now I'm seeing couples try 3, 4, 5 IVF cycles before they start to investigate that the guy may be that the man may be the culprit, and it's a lot of money wasted. So. And look, I get it. Like the REIs, the reproductive endocrinologists, at least here in Los Angeles, they're the ones who are driving a lot of the couples usually go to them first, and then they're the ones who navigate the ship. But if as a man, if you're trying to investigate to see what, at least from a diagnostic standpoint, what you can do, something as simple as doing an at-home semen analysis. There's a number of companies out there now who literally you order a test kit at home. You give a semen sample at home, you mail it into them. There's a preservative at the bottom that's able to, there's an algorithmic decay time based on that preservative that gives you a very good analysis of your fertility. And if there's any abnormalities at that point, see a specialist who could further investigate. Now, what can you do? So I would say if you have any doubt, just do an at-home test. As weird as it is to go to a doctor's office, we no longer have to do that as men. You could just do it at home. Now, what can you do in order to improve your fertility? Honestly, the beauty of fertility, anything that's good for your heart is good for your testosterone levels and it's good for your fertility. So what does that mean? Eat right, a well-balanced diet. I mean, I'm sure you've talked about this ad nauseum. You know exactly what I'm talking about. Eat right, exercise right. That's good for your hormone levels. Try to get as much sleep as possible. At least 7 hours is what I recommend. Again, good for hormone levels. And then lastly, minimize your stress, which is, if I could tell you how to do that, I'd be a very rich man. But if you could minimize your stress, again, good for hormone levels. Those four things are quite important for fertility. And the last thing I would say, anything that increases testicular temperature is no good.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic high yield summary. That being said, people do love supplements, and there's all these supplements specifically for fertility. Are there things that, I guess, are there single ingredients that you like, or are none of them worth it? Or do you go, are they situational?
So supplements, at least for men, how much a supplement can move the needle is the supplements are getting better. Let me just say this. The supplements are getting better. We know that coenzyme Q is quite important, vitamin E. There's newer companies that are introducing various antioxidants in them, and the data supports improved sperm quality, improved motility, improved morphology. How much of that? The problem with this data, at least from a fertility standpoint, is does that actually lead to improved pregnancy outcomes? And we don't know the answer to that yet, right? So although the metrics look better, what does that mean when you're trying to achieve your reproductive goals? That's TBD. My overall sense of the fertility products is they could only help you, right? Are they going to move the needle in a massive way? In some scenarios, but to me, if somebody's investing, because these fertility supplements aren't cheap, if you're investing money in these fertility supplements, taking them on a daily basis, you just become more mindful throughout the course of the day of like, oh yeah, maybe I should eat this. Maybe I should have the salad instead of the double cheeseburger. Maybe I should exercise instead of sitting on the couch. Maybe I should go to bed instead of staying up and watching a movie for 3 hours. You're making these minor lifestyle adjustments with it, therefore, compounding and further improving your, at least the lifestyle component of your fertility. So they both go hand in hand, if you will.
Yeah, it's kind of like a expensive gym membership. You're forcing yourself into a financial commitment to make you more likely to be healthy. I like that a lot.
And it works. It works.
Yeah. I think that's a pretty good summary for today. We've gone over a lot of various topics. I'm sure that there will be a lot of comments. And as people know, we love nice, mean, and in-between comments. Anything is good for the algorithm. And we'll co-post as many things as possible. But for those who don't already follow you on social media, where can people go to find more?
You can find me on any of the social media platforms, Justin Human MD. My last name is spelled Houman. I have a website. I'm based in Los Angeles. So any questions, feel free to reach out. I'm happy to help in any way.
Perfect. Well, as always, thank you for your time, and also thank you to the audience for their time listening. And may God bless you with health and happiness.